Hello.
Hi,
Hi,
everyone. This is Jeannie.
Hey, Jeannie. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
How's everybody doing this morning?
Good, thank you. Good morning, it's Jennifer.
Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, good morning.
Nice to have the snow.
So we'll get started in about 3-4 minutes, everybody.
Morning, Howard.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Doing good. Hi, Gene. So yesterday, I'm on hold for like 5 minutes waiting for the conference to start.
Oh, really?
Wrong day.
And then I realized that it was the wrong day.
You're right on top of things, man.
What can I say? Busy times.
Yeah, I got it. I got it. Did I do a good job yesterday?
It was one of my favorite ones.
All right, good.
too much. It was very interesting.
Yeah, well, I try and make them interesting. Sometimes silence is the best thing, you know.
Yes, I've known that.
Good morning.
Hi, Ann.
Good morning.
Hey, hello. How are you guys?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
Is that Ann?
It is.
Did you register? Were you okay with registering?
I haven't had time to work on it
today.
Oh, okay.
So we're supposed to get like a 50-degree temperature differential tomorrow.
Yeah, I know. You know, they're having a tremendous snow in Chicago right now.
Oh, are they really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Big trouble at the airports.
Well, I say let it stay in Chicago.
Oh, well, you know, north of us could get 18 inches. Well, north of us, across upstate New York into New England.
Yeah.
That's crazy, right?
Ready for spring.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so we're going to get started in a minute. Everybody grab their coffees and whatever else they got.
Howard, before you start, I heard a piece on NPR coming in this morning about the Department of Labor getting ready to take aim at lower-level supervisors and making them non-exempt under the FLSA.
Yeah. Yep. Yes, it's your trusty DOL on the job.
Mm. I would have a major change.
Yeah, it would have a major change. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we're going to get started, everyone. Welcome to our first March telebrief. As everybody knows, they occur on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. And this happens to be the first in March. So welcome, everybody, both our historical participants and new participants as well. So a few, I think, significant things to report on today. First, those of you who do business in Baltimore City may have seen reported in Ann Barnes' Baltimore Sun a story about the fact that the Baltimore City Council has tentatively passed a ban-the-box piece of legislation. Those of you who participated in the last telebrief we had remember that I talked about ban-the-box legislation that was passed in San Francisco and the fact that it seems to be a growing trend throughout the country. And what ban the box legislation is, for those of you who don't know, is that instead of allowing an employer to have on its application form a box which simply says, have you ever been convicted of a crime, as many of you have on your typical applications, if yes, please explain, ban the box legislation would say that it is no longer permissible to use that as an initial screening tool, that it would only be permissible to do those background checks after you've conducted an interview with the prospective employee or made a conditional offer of employment. Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the mayor of Baltimore City, has already indicated that she's going to sign this piece of legislation. So those of you who do business in Baltimore City will have to, if this becomes law, we'll have to modify your practices as to how you use criminal background checks. And we've talked about criminal background checks before in conjunction with the EEOC's stringent position on what you should and shouldn't do with regard to criminal background checks. So this is another impediment to those employers who use them, which I would venture to say is the grand majority of employers out there. I don't know exactly when it will be signed, but stay tuned and I'll let you know when it is. So those of you who do business in Baltimore City may have to modify your hiring practices to some extent. Another significant development, I've indicated to all of you in the past about the Department of Labor's rule or proposed rule regarding the advice exception to the so-called persuader rule under the Labor Management Reporting Disclosure Act, the so-called Landrum-Griffin Act of 1959. What that has to do with is that traditionally, attorneys who have advised clients who are in the midst of a union organization campaign need not report that to the Department of Labor, nor do the attorney's clients have to report that, because traditionally it was viewed as the attorney giving advice to the client. way back a couple of years ago, the Department of Labor made it known that it was going to propose a rule which would indicate that in situations where the attorney is providing labor relations advice, for instance, in the context of a union organization campaign, that the company would have to report the total amount of money spent by the company on legal advice pertaining to that organization campaign, and the attorney would have to report that as well. Now, this has been vigorously opposed, as you might imagine, by many management groups, including not a management group, but the American Bar Association and the Association of Corporate Counsel. And the reason it's been stringently opposed is because the argument goes that if attorneys and clients would have to reveal this information and what was done, it would breach the attorney-client privilege. And on that basis, I think that the opposition is very well founded. So just last week, the Department of Labor indicated to the public that it was postponing the implementation or the attempted implementation of this persuader rule under the Landrum-Griffin Act. They gave no date when it might be reinstituted. And I think the Department of Labor feels the pressure from particularly the American Bar Association, which I am sure would file a suit against the Department of Labor contending that any mandatory disclosure by an attorney and a client having to do with the advice given to a client, particularly during, for instance, a union organization campaign, would violate the attorney-client privilege, which is held to be almost inviolate under the law. So this is a significant development because it was proposed initially to go into effect this spring. Now we have no date as to when the Department of Labor would propose implementing this. And I will certainly keep you up to date, but it's a good thing for employers and those companies particularly who may be in the throes or about to be in the throes of a union organization campaign and who need and will utilize the services of labor attorneys to give them advice during that campaign. I mentioned a few weeks ago some statistics having to do with the EEOC's 2013 numbers having to do with different statistics on charges filed and et cetera. So I won't review all those, but I do want to review a couple that I think are significant. So that in 2013, retaliation claims were only one of three categories of charges whose statistics indicated an increase in 2013. And retaliation charges, according to the EEOC, represent 41.1% of all charges filed with the agency. As I indicated in prior telebriefs, it is not unusual at all today that when an employee or an ex-employee files an EEOC charge, that they frequently accompany that charge with a charge of retaliation on the basis that once a charge was filed or made known to the employer took negative action against or adverse action against that employee by either disciplining the employee, firing the employee, demoting the employee, etc. So almost half of all charges now filed with the EEOC consist not only of the substantive underlying charge of discrimination or harassment, but retaliation as well, which significantly means that those of you who have handbooks or EEO policies need to make sure that you have a very strenuous prohibition on retaliation in the workplace in your policy, and that you make known to both individuals who may have a charge as well as those who may be a witness in any kind of investigation over harassment or discrimination, that retaliation will not be permitted and that there will be zero tolerance with regard to such acts of retaliation in the workplace. So you can see the statistics bear out the fact that it's becoming increasingly common for employees or ex-employees to accompany their substantive charges of discrimination with those of retaliation. I wanted to discuss with you what I thought was a very, very interesting case coming out of the state of Florida, not federal court in Florida, but a state court in Florida. And the reason I think it's interesting is because this case deals with the intersection of social media and confidentiality provisions in settlement agreements, something that I'm sure that you all have utilized and are familiar with. So in this case, and the name of the case, by the way, is Gulliver School, Inc. versus SNAY, S-N-A-Y. And in this case, Patrick SNAY, who was a former headmaster for Gulliver Schools, had a situation where the schools did not renew his 2010 and 2011 contract as the school's headmaster. So he subsequently filed a two-count complaint asserting causes of action for age discrimination and retaliation under the Florida Civil Rights Act, which is akin to Title VII under the federal law. Now, what happened was on November 3rd, 2011, the parties entered into a settlement agreement, much like you all would probably enter into with an employee that you are about to fire. And in this settlement agreement, the amount of the money that was supposed to be paid to this fellow SNAY was $10,000 in back pay by check number one, $80,000 to him as a 1099 with check two, and $60,000 to his attorneys. Don't ever let it be said that the attorneys don't make out well in these situations. Subsequently, here's what happens. And before I get to that, let me just read the confidentiality provision that was negotiated by the parties, because it's a pretty strict confidentiality provision. It reads, the plaintiff shall not either directly or indirectly, disclose, discuss, or communicate to any entity or person except his attorneys or other professional advisors or spouse any information whatsoever regarding the existence or terms of this agreement. A breach will result in disgorgement of the plaintiff's portion of the settlement payments. Now, many of you have settlement confidentiality provisions in your settlement agreements with employees that you are about to sever, and usually those confidentiality agreements will say that the employee cannot directly or indirectly disclose the terms of the agreement, but may disclose the fact that there was an agreement reached. That's not uncommon at all. But this is a little stricter in its provisions. So only 4 days after this agreement was signed, on November 7th, 2011, Gulliver, again, the school, notified SNAY that he had breached the agreement based on a Facebook posting of SNAY's college-age daughter. So SNAY's college-age daughter posts the following on her Facebook page. Mama and Papa SNAY won the case against Gulliver. Gulliver is now officially paying for my vacation to Europe this summer. Suck it. So she posts this, and it's important to note that her comment went out to approximately 1,200 of the daughter's Facebook friends, many of whom were either current or past Gulliver students. So what happens is the school gets wind that this was on the Facebook page. They then send a letter to SNAY's attorney stating that while it was going to pay the attorney's fees portion of the party's agreement, it was going to revoke the agreement to pay SNAY any portion due to his violation of the confidentiality portion of the severance agreement. SNAY winds up suing the school for breach of the settlement agreement. And in fact, the court rules in the school district or the school's favor. And basically what they say is that in this case, the plain, unambiguous meaning of paragraph 13 of the agreement, which was the confidentiality provision, between SNE and the school is that neither SNE nor his wife would either directly or indirectly disclose to anyone other than their lawyers or professionals any information regarding the existence or the terms of the parties' agreement. They go on to say, rather, before the ink was dry on the agreement, and notwithstanding the clear language of Section 13 mandating confidentiality, SNE violated the agreement by doing exactly what he had promised not to do. His daughter then did precisely what the confidentiality agreement was designed to prevent, advertising to the Gulliver community that SNE had been successful in his age discrimination and retaliation case against the school. Now, granted, this involves a pretty unusual set of facts and circumstances, but I think it's important because, as I said in the beginning of the discussion, it involves the intersection of social media along with substantive contract law. So here you had a severance agreement, which was passed or entered into or negotiated between the parties, which was a pretty stringent confidentiality agreement. And those of you out there who have confidentiality agreements with employees that you're about to sever might think about including the kind of language that was in this particular agreement. It also, I think, implicates the fact that Facebook, despite the fact that it may have been utilized by a family member, not the person who was actually entering into the agreement, became public knowledge. And because the confidentiality agreement prohibited either the direct or indirect disclosure, and in this case, the disclosure was indirectly through the plaintiff Snay's daughter, that confidentiality agreement or part of the agreement was therefore violated. So, a couple things. One, obviously, if you enter into a severance agreement with an employee or are about to enter into a severance agreement with an employee, you certainly want to make sure that, without a doubt, you have strong confidentiality protections in your agreement. And you want to indicate that those confidentiality protections will be both or flow to both direct statements made by the employee as well as statements that were made by those who should be similarly bound by the confidentiality provisions, including his attorneys, his family, etc. The other aspect, of course, to this case is the social media aspect, which is the fact that information becomes readily available to companies today, much more readily available, and that those things that are posted on Facebook can and do come back to haunt employees as well as employers if things are said in the wrong way too. So while this is a Florida state court case, I think it's very, very instructive and very timely in terms of what we do with regard to our severance agreements and how we monitor from time to time social media sources. And in talking about severance agreements, I know that I mentioned probably a month ago in a telebrief a case that had been brought against CVS by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission having to do with severance agreements. I'm not going to rehash everything that I said in that telebrief, but I, through many blogs on the internet and through labor lawyers and employment lawyers, I think it's important to note that when you are entering into severance agreements with employees or about to, that you know that employees cannot be compelled to waive their right to file a charge with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, even if they cannot collect any kind of monetary damages from the EEOC. So typically what you'll find in severance agreements today is a provision that says that nothing in the agreement will prohibit the employee from filing a charge or pursuing his rights under Title VII or any other statute. However, the employee, by entering in the agreement, waives any right to any subsequent monetary relief. Because of the position taken by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in this case against CVS, you may want to bold and separate that language in your separation agreements so that it appears very prominently to the employee, and if the EEOC takes a look at your agreement, they won't have the same problems necessarily that they are alleging with CVS having to do with their severance agreements. Keep in mind, as I stated a few weeks ago, I don't believe for a minute that an appellate court will uphold in total the EEOC's restrictions on the use of some of these things in severance agreements, but I do think that we need to follow it to see how the courts deal with the position that has been espoused by the EEOC in its lawsuit. I wanted to bring to your attention a case that was very recently decided, February 28th, as a matter of fact, by the National Labor Relations Board in a case called Copper River of Bowling Springs. And significantly in this case, we had two Republican board members outvote the Democratic chairman, Mark Gaston Pierce, to find that a South Carolina restaurant company did not violate the restrictions in federal labor law by maintaining a rule in its handbook restricting employees from, in quotes, displaying a negative attitude, close quotes, in dealing with fellow employees or restaurant patrons. So members Philip Massimera and Harry Johnson outvoted Mr. Pierce and found that the rule that had been promulgated and published by the employer in its handbook only prohibited conduct which was harmful to the employer's legitimate business concerns. And in this particular case, two employees had been terminated during an organizing effort, and they had been terminated because the restaurant had received reports from the managers that they had used profanity to disparage the restaurant in conversations with its customers. The gist of the position taken by the minority, that is the chairman, was that such a provision could potentially impede the rights of these employees to criticize the employer and to engage in protected concerted activity under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. However, the particular provision in question here basically stated as follows. It prohibited insubordination to a manager or lack of respect and cooperation with fellow employees or guests, and specified, in quotes, this includes displaying a negative attitude that is disruptive to other staff or has a negative impact on guests. The majority in this case found that the rule on employee attitudes was not materially distinguishable from the rule that had been approved in a prior case called Hyundai America. And the restaurant's policy, they wrote, limits the rule to unprotected conduct that would interfere with the respondent's legitimate business concerns. And so, as I've stated to you frequently in the past, the Labor Board is now looking at handbook provisions with a fine-tooth comb. However, it is comforting to see that, in this case, a majority of the board members who had this case, there were three board members, found in a common sense manner that a provision in a handbook basically prohibiting any kind of insubordination or a negative attitude that would have an adverse effect on guests would be a very reasonable response by an employer, irrespective of the typical Democratic attitude on the board today, which is that if you can possibly envision a situation where somebody might exercise or attempt to exercise a Section 7 right to engage in concerted protected activity, that therefore would be an overbroad rule by the employer justifying the labor board to invalidate it. So I think that while certainly we see the great trend at the labor board in invalidating certain rules that have been promulgated by employers and handbooks, this is a good example of common sense prevailing, and the common sense obviously prevailed by virtue of the two Republican members on the particular panel that discussed and decided this case. So again, if you are looking at your handbook policies, and I've stated this before, you want to make sure that your handbook policies have a disclaimer in there, whether it's the beginning of your handbook, someplace in the beginning, or some other place, that basically states that nothing in your handbook or your policies will be construed to prohibit the exercise of rights guaranteed to employees under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, or indeed any other statute, local, federal, or state. So those are the developments of the day. You know, many of them are very, very recent, and the benefit, I think, of these telebriefs is that we can concentrate on the things that are very recent. Next, the next telebrief, obviously, will be the fourth Wednesday in April, which happens to be March the 26th, pardon me. And the ones in April will be on April 9th and April 23rd. Tomorrow, which is March 13th, I am putting on a webinar from 1:30 to 3 o'clock entitled Monitoring and Restricting Employee Conduct from Speaking Out to Lighting Up. And we're going to be covering a large amount of topics, from smoking in the workplace to criminal background checks, privacy rights, etc. It's an hour and a half webinar. People can get a one and a half continuing education credits. The typical cost for this would be $219, but for Offit-Kerman clients and our friends and network sources, it's complimentary. If you're interested at all in participating in this, Jeannie's on the phone. She can, you know, point you in the right direction. I think all you really need to do is email her, and she can get you registered or help you register for the webinar tomorrow. So feel free to join that discussion. Should be pretty interesting for an hour and a half tomorrow afternoon, 1:30 to 3. As always, I indicate that if anybody's got any questions or comments at this point, feel free to raise them now, or if you'd rather do it in private, my personal phone number is 410-209-6417, and my email address is hkerman, H-K-U-R-M-A-N, at offitkerman, O-F-F-I-T-K-U-R-M-A-N .com.
Howard, it's Ann Barnes. I do have a question.
Yep.
This goes back to the ban the box legislation.
Yes.
Does that deal just with employment that would be the person working would be in Baltimore City, or it's a restriction on an employer based in Baltimore City but may have offices outside of the city?
And I haven't seen the specific wording, but my gut would tell me that it would apply to any employees working in Baltimore City. I don't think the city council would have jurisdiction to mandate that for companies that are doing business beyond the jurisdictional limits of the city.
So, like, you know, my company, we've got offices inside the city and outside, so we could have potentially a dual track here.
You could.
Okay.
Yep, I think that's
right. Yeah, obviously we need to see the legislation. Thank you.
Yep, sure. Any other questions?
Howard, my question was the same as Ann's. Now, we don't have any offices in the city, but obviously we have contracts in the city, but I'm assuming that because we're located outside the city, this would not affect us.
I think that's right, Mike, but I want to see the actual legislation, which is signed, when it will be signed, by the mayor, and then I'll make sure that everybody knows what the deal is with regard to whether you can be excluded from this because you don't have an office in Baltimore City, but you may do business in Baltimore City, or the other way around. You have an office in Baltimore City, but you also do business outside of the city. So I just have to see the legislation, and I haven't seen it.
Now, I have one more question. Is there anything that Baltimore or Maryland can do to drive businesses any further out of this area?
I think that there are always good faith efforts that are taken by the legislature in that regard, particularly in Maryland. We're not known as a very favorable state towards employers. We're not quite as bad as California, but
right,
we're not great either. Okay, well, listen, everybody, thanks a lot for participating.
Thank you.
Maybe I will see you, in quotes, tomorrow at the webinar, and if not, hopefully we'll see you at the next telebrief. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Howard. Very informative.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Howard.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.